Hey, it's Anna Sale, and I want to thank you for listening to Death, Sex, and Money, where I explore the big questions and hard choices that are often left out of polite conversation. You can hear new episodes ad-free every week on Amazon Music, where you can find Death, Sex, and Money and all of your Slate favorites without the ads.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
Oh, Biggie Smalls, don't even get me started. Someone's like, my birthday is March 5th. And that's close to March 9th, which is the day I got my period, which is also the day that Biggie Smalls died. I'm just crazy. Just like, on the day. Like, I don't know why I need to tell everybody that, but I do.
This is Death, Sex, and Money.
It's just that when he was younger, he used to lie about his mother being alive.
The show from WNYC about the things we think about a lot.
What about all those condoms I got you?
Hmm?
We used them.
And need to talk about more.
Gambling is not your problem.
I'm Anna Sale. If you know Gabourey Sidibe, it's probably from Precious, the 2009 movie about rape, physical abuse, and poverty in one young woman's life. Gabourey was 24 when she got the role. It was her first acting job, and it earned her an Oscar nomination.
I knew that whatever Precious was going to be, whatever the film was going to be, that it was going to change my life. And it had better, it changed my life for the better. Like, I really, really wanted that because that's what I prayed for.
Did it initially?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, my life is so much better. Look, with anyone who has their dream job, I'm sure there are things that they hate about it. Before I was an actress, nobody said anything about my body. They did when I was a kid, but once I became, you know, a person, when I was 18, 19 in college and in real life, nobody said anything about my body ever. And being an actress allowed people to begin to say things about my body again.
Gabourey is responding right now to all that talk with a new book. It's called This Is Just My Face, Try Not to Stare. It's about her life after Precious and before, when she was a teenager growing up in New York.
The 90s were popping, okay? And I don't know if you remember TRL, Total
of course
Request
I do.
Live. I would cut school and we would go down, if NSYNC were going to be there, and you could just stand under the window and watch them. And there were so many things to show up to, and it felt like it was like a lifestyle. It was like what I was doing.
NSYNC was your extracurricular activity.
Exactly. NSYNC was my extracurricular activity. It made me feel like I had things to do when everything else was so screwed up.
Gabourey's parents divorced when she was 9. Her dad drove a cab. Her mom was a teacher. But she left that job when she realized she could earn at least the same amount of money performing in the subways.
My mom is she's a phenomenal singer, but when she started singing in the subway, it was hard to watch. Because at that point, my mom, my brother, and I, we all shared two twin beds in a room at my aunt's house. And it felt like no matter how talented she was, we still had to go back and sleep in these twin beds. That we were still going to walk away poor, even though she was really, really talented. And so my brother and I would just kind of wander off by ourselves, and I'd find a book, and there was a bookstore in Penn Station where they would just let me come in and sit down on the floor in the hall.
But these escapes were temporary. Gabrielle was struggling. After her parents split, she started having panic attacks almost daily.
I was crying and sweating and not being able to breathe. And this would happen, you know, sometimes first period in junior high or, you know, during math in elementary school or, you know, recess or something. And I remember when I was in seventh grade, there was like, you know, parent-teacher night or something. And so my mom and I went down to the school, and my seventh grade homeroom teacher, Mr. Maloff, who was really kind of too sexy for a science teacher, but he was telling my mom, he was like, you know, she cries a lot. She cries too much. You know, she lets the other kids really get to her, and she needs to thicken her skin, and she, you know, this is really a problem. And my mom kind of seemed to be embarrassed by it. And I was extremely embarrassed that my teacher, who was so sexy, had to tell my mom that I was crying too much and that the both of them were looking at me as though I actually had some control in the matter, and I didn't. There are a lot of things going on, and so neither of my parents saw me. They just couldn't see me or who I was or what was happening to me or what I was going through.
Throughout her teens, Gabrielle had anxiety, depression, and bulimia. She says making herself throw up gave her a sense of relief. She graduated high school and started taking college courses in psychology. She also started acting in school productions, but she still felt lost.
All of my friends are, you know, hooking up with guys and going to parties and going on dates and having boyfriends and things like that. And I wasn't doing any of that. And I said, okay, that's what you have to do to be normal. Because right now you don't feel normal, but you will feel normal as soon as you become normal. And that's what you got to do to become normal.
You describe what you call your hoe phase.
I was just doing it to do it. Like, I just... And it's not, I mean, this sounds like, the hoe phase sounds like there was a line outside of my bedroom, and there wasn't. And it wasn't like, I'll take anybody on. It wasn't like that. I just kind of hung out with people that did not serve or deserve me.
And are these, at that point in your life, like, where were you meeting these people? Parties?
Oh, my God. Anyone who lives in New York City... that lives in the hood knows that all you have to do is walk to the train and people will yell at you. And people are like, hey, girl, come here. Like, you know, there were a lot of like, yo, shorty. And so that's how I would meet people. On the way to the train, the classy way.
Well, I imagine it felt, I mean, you described earlier that when you were like in middle school and high school, it felt like you weren't being seen. And that made you feel seen, walking to the train, having people notice you.
Exactly. When I was in junior high and high school, and, you know, the thing was, you know, I went to school with all of these, like, beautiful Puerto Rican and Dominican girls, and, you know, and they had all the boyfriends, and, you know, they were the ones that the boys wanted, and I was really funny with a great personality. And so all the boys that I liked just wanted to be my best friend. And, you know, but the guys that were standing, you know, on the block on my way to the train station had no idea if I had a great personality or if they wanted to be my best friend. They knew that they wanted to, like, kind of be inside me, which is such a gross thing to say, oh my God. But they wanted something from me. Whether I wanted to give it to them didn't matter to me, because what I really wanted was to be wanted.
So how long did that phase last?
Less than a year.
That's a very short hoe phase for a young woman.
It's a short hoe. I mean, like, yeah. Like, it's such a short hoe phase. It's more like a hoe-fa, you know? Like, it's not a full phase.
That phase was long enough for Gabrielle to realize she needed help. She was on Medicaid, which covered antidepressants and therapy 5 days a week for 6 months, both on her own and in group sessions.
I was the youngest person in the class by, like, a lot. Everyone else was, you know, in their 40s. And it was very strange because I couldn't, you know, deal with my life. But I always imagined that by the time I was 40, I could. And it was really, and this is, I mean, this is no shade on those people that were in that group. I was devastated to learn that I wasn't going to magically be a better person by the time I was 25. But that's something I had to learn. I had to learn that what I was going through, I couldn't grow out of. And that's a really good lesson for me to have learned when I was 21. I'm so grateful that I didn't have to sit in sickness and sit in depression until I was dead.
Gabourey decided not to go back to school after this. She needed money. Her therapist suggested she try telemarketing. Gabourey took her advice, sort of.
I found a job as a phone sex operator. I think my audition call, the first call, like this guy is like, ugh, my dick is so hard or whatever. And I had no idea what to do with a hard dick. Like, and yeah, I wasn't a virgin, but like, what do I know? I don't know. I don't know what to do in person. I don't know how to describe it over the phone. But what was great is I'm on the phone. You can't see me. And so I would do most of my calls with a Cosmo magazine and also it was called like Cherry Pie or something. Oh. Some like porno magazine. Uh-huh. Where like all these, I mean, it's just like photographs, but it's, you know, graphic in nature. And so it was really easy to just describe what I saw.
Do you think that job helped you as a performer?
Definitely. Certainly, because I was never, almost never was I a black girl on the phone. Hmm. Never. And like, I want to be very frank about this. The people that ran the company, most, I want to say 95% of them are black women. But we were not allowed to have black voices on the phone. You'd have a white voice.
What's your white voice sound like?
Pretty much this. Uh-huh. So there are a bunch of different lines. And so I got to try on a lot of different voices. Like for college girl, my voice would be more like this. You know, like I would just like yeah. end every sentence with an upward inflection because I'm just kind of like, I'm really cute and stuff like that. But I'm also like a little bit dumb. But never a black girl. Although there's a line. So there, like, I'm telling you, there's like hundreds of lines that filter all into one company. And I was horrible at the black girl calls.
Huh.
Why? Because of racism. Because I am a black girl. And so I refuse to talk like this so that you could believe that I'm a black girl and have an attitude because that is rude because I be reading this shit. So like that felt really, I would not yeah. do that.
So you're both like learning about what it is to be an object of sexual desire and you're learning about being a performer without your body being a part of the equation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a trip.
Yeah, what did that feel like?
I felt like I could be really, really powerful as long as you could not see me. Which is a really interesting thing to come from when you become an actress. To go from, you know, this brunette who's really cute with like a heart-shaped butt and, you know, really perky titties. To go from that to like being the face of, you know, dark-skinned black girl from the hood as Precious, you know, who, you know, is a sexual abuse survivor. I think that was heavier than I allowed myself to know it was at the time.
Coming up, Gabourey talks about getting that role just as she was settling in at the phone sex company.
And so it felt like this is what I'm supposed to be, but it also felt like a trap because everyone gets a girl number. And my girl number was 1266 because I was the 1,266th employee hired by the entire company. But number two was still there. Number five, number 20, number 100, they were all still there because they were trapped.
Thank you
to all of you who submitted life advice questions for our live show last week with comedian Hari Kondabolu and his mom, Uma. It was really fun, and they gave really good advice.
Just get to know each other, and once you trust he has a sound judgment, he means well, then decide.
And if he like flips out about this, well then, you know,
then he's not the guy.
Right, and find out whether you can get it annulled.
We'll have that in the podcast feed next week, or you can watch the video now on our Facebook page. An email came in after that show from a listener who we think you might be able to help out. Marlena is 46 years old, and she's on her way to becoming a stepmother to three boys. She's never been married or had kids before. She's wondering how other people have handled that transition to becoming a step-parent. She wrote, "It seems like such a culturally fraught relationship, and that there are so many ways to have things go wrong." So send us any lessons you've learned about step-parenthood, what you've done right or what you've done wrong. We'll put your advice in our newsletter next week. If you don't already get it, go to deathsexmoney.org/newsletter to subscribe. Or just text the word newsletter to 69866. We love watching you help each other out in the Death, Sex, and Money community, which, by the way, includes Gabrielle Sidibe.
I'm such a huge fan.
Oh.
I've listened to almost nearly every single episode of Death, Sex, and Money.
Are you serious? That's awesome. Let me tell you a good story. It was late on a Sunday afternoon, and my family and I had been away and rolled into the driveway, and everyone was worn out from traveling and getting hangry. But waiting for us was a solution. A Hungry Root box filled with healthy, grabbable snacks and a few different dinner meals to choose from. We tore into this thing like a pack of wild animals and ate all the snacks. But they were healthy, whole ingredients, fresh produce. And then we were set for dinner a few hours later, which only took about 15 minutes to prep and cook and get on the table. I was so grateful to my past self for doing my current self this solid by ordering this box. And it was easy. I took a short quiz to tell Hungry Root what kinds of meat my family eats, the sorts of flavors we like, any dietary restrictions we have, or just things we're trying to avoid, and when I wanted the box to be delivered. Right now, Hungry Root is offering Death, Sex, and Money listeners 40% off your first delivery and free veggies for life. Just go to hungryroot.com/DSM to get 40% off your first delivery and get your free veggies. That's hungryroot.com/DSM. And don't forget to use our link so they know we sent you.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen. And her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
I want to thank you for listening and for all your support as we at Death, Sex, and Money have made our move to Slate. Your stories, voice memos, and emails have meant so much to the team. As part of this transition, there's a new way to support our show financially at Slate, our new home, and you'll get something special in return. Subscribe to Slate Plus, and you'll not only support our work on Death, Sex, and Money, you'll get access to new benefits, including listening to us and all of the other great shows Slate makes, like Slow Burn and Dakota Ring, without any ads or sponsor breaks. To subscribe, just click Try Free at the top of the Death, Sex, and Money show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/DSM Plus to get access wherever you listen. Thanks. This is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC. I'm Anna Sale. In the 8 years since Gabrielle Sidibe was cast as Precious, she's been working steadily in big budget movies like Tower Heist and on TV in American Horror Story, The Big C, and Empire. It's something Gabrielle never could have imagined when she went to an open audition for Precious and then got called back to meet director Lee Daniels.
And after you know, half an hour, maybe 40 minutes of him just talking to me, just interviewing me. He just gave me the role without a third audition. He just gave it to me. I was just praying that whoever and whatever I was supposed to be would begin. Because I had a feeling that, like, being...
Begin, you said.
Yeah, to begin. I just wanted who I am and what I was supposed to be and my purpose to begin.
I mean, Precious was a huge cultural phenomenon. You're nominated for an Oscar. You're all over red carpets everywhere. And you are being consumed as a product of media and talked about and picked apart. How did you deal with that?
I'm so happy I got that whole pesky panic attack thing, you know, out of the way. But it was really, you know, it was really hurtful. And it took a while for me to learn that I was never going to out-talent the fact that I should be skinny in, you know, in somebody else's eyes. That I was never going to be funny enough to make people forget that I'm fat. It's not something, I always say, you know, confidence is not something that you can set and forget. You have to work on it every day, to put it on like lipstick. There will always be comments. The internet is not going away. Thank God, because I'm always bored, but still, it's never going away. Dealing with it has got to come from inside me.
Gabourey decided to get weight loss surgery about a year ago. She'd considered it earlier, in her early 20s, but had just finished treatment for her eating disorder. Doctors told her she wasn't a good candidate then because surgery can cause you to throw up after eating and could trigger her bulimia.
I remember thinking I really screwed myself, you know. I really screwed myself out of not being, you know, I'm no longer able to have this surgery because I really messed up. And I stopped thinking about it for a while, but I thought about it again when I was 27 because I think this, what I, people think that I don't care that I am bigger, that I don't notice. And I've been fat since I was, you know, very young, 4 or 5 years old. The bulk of my family is big. I know. I'm worried. Strangers think that they're more worried about me than I am. Just like, can you chill? I'm very aware of what's going on with me. And people think that I'm lazy, but I have been working. Lee gave me my first trainer, like, the day he hired me. He's like, we'll get you a trainer. He's like, we got to get you on a regimen and we got to get you healthy. And we'll, you know, and he was sending me to yoga instructors and sending me to dietitians because he's like, not only do I want to get you through the filming of this movie, I want you to be a star after. I want this to be your first of many roles. And so he's, you know, he's on my team. He's on my side. He always has been. But we had to do reshoots. And what happened, I remember I came in one day and the pants that they had for me, like, was just falling off of me. And so they had to put pins in them to keep them on. And he was like, so, hey, baby, we have reshoots coming up in about 3 weeks. How much weight have you lost? He's like, can you just stop working out? Stay right where you are because we can't have you lose any more weight. And I think that if you ate a little bit of cake, that, you know, we won't be in so much trouble.
And how did getting that instruction, like, how did that feel? Because you're doing all this work, you've changed your habits, you're losing weight.
Yeah, it was, I don't think it was initially devastating. Like at that moment, I probably felt kind of dope about it. Like, I kind of felt like, yes, lost so much weight. They hating on how much weight I lost because, yes, like, I kind of felt, like, really proud of myself. Because I also didn't realize, that stopping and backsliding would be a fall down the mountain, you know. I gained all the weight back and then some, and then even more some. So.
How did you decide to get the surgery and how did you understand the risk that you were taking?
So it happened very quickly. I knew that one of the risks our death is definitely a thing to worry about, different complications. And, you know, also I, whether I want it to or not, I am a fat actress. And that's like kind of the realm that I'm in, even though my career is not about my body. But that was definitely a worry that I had. I didn't tell my manager or my agents. I didn't tell anyone.
Oh, you did it in secret.
I didn't. I had the surgery in May, and my mom didn't know till September.
Why?
A few reasons. I had made up my mind, and I didn't want space for anybody else's mind to be made up about it. And so I wanted my opinion and my comfort and my safety to be the only thing that mattered surrounding the surgery.
How would you describe your relationship with your family when it comes to money?
I mean, what I'm envisioning, as you said that, I envision myself standing on a patch of grass out in a field, and there's a brick wall next to me, and on the other side of that brick wall is my family. Hmm. And it's like, you know, 8 feet across, but they can come around, and I can go around there, but I won't.
How come?
I really, you know, it's so odd. Money is so odd, and it's so strange. And it continues to befuddle me because I have some. I'm not rich. I have some. But my family has the same amount as they did when I was living with them. And if they ask me for money, I'm just as upset as if they don't ask me for money and need it. And so it's a very strange thing. It's very strange, and I'm still trying to work out my feelings around it. But I want my family to have a better life, and I want them to be good, and I want them to not worry. But the idea of them not worrying fills me with so much worry, because even if I, like, help them out of a jam or, you know, pay the rent or this and that, you know, I'm so scared about whether or not I'll be able to do this the next time, you know. I don't know what will happen. Who can I turn to help me out? Because there's not one person in my family that I can depend on the way they can depend on me, financially speaking.
Fabry feels like she's got enough money now, but it took a while to feel that way. She says in her book she earned about $30,000 from Precious, and it went fast. By the time Oscar season came around, she was walking alongside the world's most famous actors on red carpets.
With zero money in the bank. Yeah. And not that I spent it on frivolous things. I just didn't spend it on anything good. I couldn't buy a car. Didn't even drive then. I couldn't buy a house or an apartment. Like, that was insane. And so I think that what I did with the money is I got out of credit card debt.
Uh-huh.
That's it.
That's it.
End of list. I had a debt. This is so stupid. I had a debt from Crunch Gym, from a membership that I signed up for. And, like, I remember the debt wasn't even that big, but it definitely went to, like, a collection agency. But it was, like, maybe, it was, like, $3,000 or something. And I remember the day I paid it off, because the creditor, like, she would, you know, call me once a month, and I was doing, like, a, you know, a monthly thing, you know. And I called her, and I was like, I forget her name. Let's call her Lisa. I was like, Lisa, I'm going to pay the whole thing off now. And she was like, what? I'm like, yeah. And she's like, what happened? Did you get a promotion? And I was like, girl, I got a movie. And she's like, what? And she was like, that is so good for you. Lisa was so happy for me.
I love picturing Lisa going to see Precious. She must have been so proud.
I hope she was. But that is all I did with the money. That's what I did with it. Yeah.
That's Gabourey Sidibe. Her new memoir is called This Is Just My Face, Try Not to Stare. You can also still see her on the show Empire. And check out her turn as Ella Fitzgerald on Comedy Central's Drunk History. We loved it, and think you will too. The link is up on our Facebook page. Death, Sex, and Money is a listener-supported production of WNYC Studios in New York. I'm based at the Center for Investigative Reporting in Emeryville, California. The team includes Katie Bishop, Emily Botine, and Andrew Dunn. We had help this week from Derek John and Destry Sibley. The Reverend John DeLore and Steve Lewis wrote our theme music. I'm on Twitter at Anna Sale. The show is at Death, Sex, Money. And again, subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Go to deathsexmoney.org/newsletter. And we are still collecting your stories about student loans. Write us an email or record a voice memo and send it to us at deathsexmoney@wnyc.org. Gabourey says she will always be a New Yorker at heart, but she also loves a swimming pool.
I swim. I can swim a lap in 21 seconds.
So when she bought a place, it was in L.A.
Oh my God, I'm so fancy. I have a white picket fence in Bougainvillea Tree.
You do?
And I'm embarrassed by it, honestly. I'm like, if a friend comes to my house and I'm like, yeah, it's the one with the white picket fence. It's stupid. Never mind. It's like, just, it's the white picket fence. And like, all of my friends are like, what? It's just a little on the nose, you know?
I'm Anna Sale, and this is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC.